Hi, good morning. I am going to introduce our speaker, Reverend Gregory Hahn. He's here from Interfaith Ministries, which St. Paul's has long been a partner of. And I like this description of himself. Describes himself as a half Asian, Midwestern raised, Jesuit educated, Harvard trained, Texas residing Presbyterian minister. So that's a good long list. So Greg has lived in Houston for 19 years, worked as a hospital chaplain, and then spent 8 years in Presbyterian churches as associate and solo pastor roles. For 6 years, he taught at St. John's School, which is where I spent a few years in high school as well, but not during the time you were there, and taught English, electives in religion, and directed the chapel program there. Since June 2014, he's been the director of the interfaith relations at Interfaith Ministries, and it's Houston's oldest interfaith service organization, does a lot of great things in Houston. So he's responsible for the agency's outreach that builds relationships, provides resources, and mobilizes communities in this very, very diverse city. So I think he's going to tell us a little bit about that and hopefully a little bit about his very interesting and layered background. But please welcome Reverend Gregory Hahn.
I have been here in Houston. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. I've been in Houston again for almost 20 years. It's now the place that I have lived longer than any other place. And I know your congregation well. I know Jim Bankston, Tommy Williams, my in-laws actually attend. Oh, please don't be here. Oh, good, you're not here. All right. No. And I know, I guess I first heard of Ordinary Life back in 2000 when I was doing CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education at St. Luke's and Texas Children's. One of my CPE classmates was a young woman named Stephanie Warfield. So some of you probably remember Stephanie, and Stephanie spoke so highly of Bill and of this class, and how for many it is a home when perhaps in other places on your faith, religious, non-faith journeys, you perhaps didn't find a home or didn't find a place or didn't find a community that was a place that was more interested in the capacious and expansive nature of the gospel and of faith. So I think I've got you nailed pretty well, I think. So, and I know, again, how important you are to this community and that St. Paul's has been a longtime supporter of Interfaith Ministries. I'm going to go through a lot of information. I always get nervous. Should I focus on one thing in particular and dive deep, or should I realize this may be the first and the last time I may be with a group, and so I should just try to cover everything. So knowing that I may not get invited back, I try to cover everything. So let me tell you a little bit about who's familiar with Interfaith Ministries. I bet a lot of you are. Thank you. We're Houston's oldest interfaith service organization. I'll run through the background about interfaith pretty quickly here. Dialogue, collaboration, and service, strength of shared beliefs. Those are our the two straws that stir our drink. And so we've done a variety of things over the years when it comes to service. Houston Food Bank started with us, Kids Meal started with us, but probably for the last 10 to 15 years, we have focused on two service areas. Again, we trace our roots back into the mid-1950s when a group of Protestant churches got together and realized they could do more together than apart. It was called the Church Welfare Bureau, then the Jewish community joined in. People who have been in Houston a long time will remember us as Houston Metropolitan Ministries, which is our name, particularly through the late 60s, 70s, and 80s. And in 1992, we changed our name to Interfaith Ministries for Greater Houston, which is a good name. It's also slightly problematic. Probably get a phone call once or twice a month saying, so when are church services? And understandably so, they think we're a religious organization, and we are not actually. We are 501c3. We are not affiliated with any religious tradition, but we take religion seriously, knowing that faith communities are the backbone of the work that we do. Our program areas, most people know us for, we run Houston's, Harris County's largest Meals on Wheels program. That's the fifth largest Meals on Wheels program in America. and all the things you can do delivering 4,000 meals a day, home health checks, light housework, the very fact that you're visiting older Americans who are isolated and food vulnerable, usually at least once a week, if not once every weekday. Our Anna Meals program, when we saw that a lot of our clients had pets and didn't have pet food, so we deliver almost 100,000 pounds of pet food a year. So great, great work that we do there. Some of pictures of our work. Then refugee services, these are a little outdated. The number should be 2,000. We help serve about 2,000 refugees every year from 17 different countries now coming to, again, America looking for a new life, and especially here to Houston, which is a wonderful center for resettling refugees because of our diverse community. This seeing eye chart, again, when people say refugees, they're just pouring in, we don't know who they are, nothing could be further from the truth. If you're a terrorist trying to come into the United States as a refugee, you are a very patient terrorist. I'll just leave it at that. From home to, again, they usually have fled from their country of origin and been resettled someplace else. So they have been on the road for a long time, and the refugee process takes 18 to 24 months. We meet them at the airport, home, ESL classes, kids in school, job training, jobs. It's, again, a wonderful work as well. I head up the third area. You could think of us as both a third service area. You could also think of us as the plate upon which all of this work happens because of strength of shared beliefs, dialogue, collaboration, and service. A lot of the things we do, people call us looking for resources. We'd love to visit three houses of worship. Can you help us? Absolutely. Yesterday I had barbecue with the Muslims over at River Oaks Islamic Center over on East Side. I wish some of you could have been there. There was a community barbecue. So barbecue for lunch and then Indian food for dinner at the Hindu Youth Awards. So that's really a snapshot of the kind of work we do, resourcing, connecting, being with people across religious traditions. Speaker requests, networking, resources, a lot of work behind the scenes. Our most well-known program in my department is our Dinner Dialogues, which we've been doing for the last 10 years, bringing people from different religions around tables with moderated discussion about what our differences are and what our similarities are. We're not out to make some religious, goo of sameness. You may be familiar with the concept of Esperanto, the idea of trying to create in Europe one common language, trying to take the best of every language so that everyone would speak the same language. And it was a colossal failure because I think people realize there's a richness. Again, interfaith only works when there's different faiths interacting with one another. Youth Service Day, we had over 200 kids on MLK Monday with five different service projects. And then here, two Buddhists, Unity Church, Presbyterian, United Methodist, United Church of Christ, United Methodist, Lutheran, and one more Presbyterian. Faith leaders around a table, we're working on some common issues. You don't have to look too far. That's sort of my introduction to interfaith. In other words, so just ask me more, get in touch with us. We always need your support, and we're grateful for St. Paul's support. You don't have to look far into the news to realize that religion still makes a difference. John Kerry, when he was here at Rice University last year, said this: "In fact, if I went back to college today, I think I would probably major in comparative religion, because that's how integrated religion is in everything that we are working on and deciding and thinking about in life today." And that's why I've enjoyed focusing and studying religion for the last 20 years, ever since my first theology class at Georgetown, because I'm never bored. There's always something interesting going on. A little bit about diversity in Houston. Some of you have probably seen these stats. Who has heard Steven Kleinberg from the Kinder Institute speak? Okay, I've stolen basically all of his data, so. We're fortunate Steven Kleinberg and the Kinder Institute has one of the longest running surveys of any major metropolitan area in the country. He's been running the Houston area survey for 35 years. And so an incredible amount of data over a long period of time that tells us what Houstonians think on a host of different topics. So we are the city that eats cities. I grew up in northern Wisconsin and spent 10 years on the East Coast. Particularly those 10 years, I'm familiar with really urban, dense areas, DC and Boston in particular. We like our space. So we're the city that eats cities. You could fit Chicago, Baltimore, Detroit, and Philadelphia into Houston's city limits. Interesting to think, we're about to pass Chicago as the number three population-wise in the country. They're one-third our geographic footprint. If it ever feels like you've driven across the state to get from point A to point B, it's because you have. Our 10-county region's bigger than the state of New Jersey. Demographic transformations, all the way from 1960, where you can just see a little sliver, 0.3% green of Asians, all the way up to 6.8% in 2014, we've seen our city transform demographically. And with that demographic diversity comes country of origin, ethnic diversity, religious diversity, and all of the pros and the cons, all the growing pains that comes from people from different backgrounds being together. I think we've done a lot well. I think some of it we've benefited from a strong economy. And while we're a diverse city, I would say we're also a very segregated city as well. And interestingly, if you want to see real kind of integration of different ethnic groups or religious groups, it's actually out in the suburbs, where affordable housing is a wonderful equalizer when it comes to people living side by side. So as you can see, our African American population percentage-wise has remained relatively stable, but our Anglo percentage, not numbers, but percentage has shifted, particularly while our Latino and Asian population, this is Harris County. It's suburbs are even more pronounced. Fort Bend County, Missouri City, Stafford, Sugar Land is considered the most diverse county in the United States. And even usually traditionally very white, Montgomery County, Willis, Conroe, the Woodlands, is seeing tremendous changes just over 20 years. So we need to decide how we're going to leverage these changes for good. And I know that Mayor Turner, I've heard him speak quite a few times, is concerned about this. I love this shot. This is downtown Houston. Anybody seen these photos? Love these photos. Downtown Houston, you can sort of orient yourself. The photo's looking kind of northeast to southwest. You can see the Pierce Elevated. This is 1978, and this is 2011. So I'll do that one again, because this really is in a snapshot. So many things you could deconstruct and parse, whether it's a picture of suburban flight. Because where was everybody living? In the suburbs. What do you need downtown? Parking. All the way to the revitalization of downtown where people are living and working and playing. How many religions? Okay, I don't have time for this. All right, there you go. You name it, we have it here. And again, every religious tradition is as diverse as whatever religious tradition you're most familiar with. Every other religious tradition is just as diverse. I'll go back to this one. If trends continue, and we know that population trends are not a steady line of progression, they shift and they turn. But by 2050, Christians will go from 3/4 to 2/3 of the U.S. population. But it's not because other religious traditions are coming in and taking over. Ah, the Muslims are coming. From 0.9 to 2.1% of the U.S. population, it's that growth in the unaffiliated, what we call the nuns, not the nuns, but the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. People who don't particularly affiliate with any religious tradition, which could become about 1/4 of the U.S. population. And probably an affiliation some of you here, or many of you here, may sympathize with or take on, but you're still here. The myth is that unaffiliated folks are tired of church, are not religious. You're incredibly religious. I think we really do this group a disservice by some of the labels that we put on them. I wanted to write an article, not calling them nuns, but calling them sums. They have something. To call them nuns, I think, is quite insulting. You could be to any one of these places in 20 minutes. This is where I was last night for dinner and for the Hindu Youth Awards. The BAPS, the BAPS Hindu Mandir in Stafford, Sri Meenakshi Temple in Pearland, the Hare Krishna Temple in the Heights. Great vegan restaurant that just opened there called Govinda's. Highly recommend it. Annunciation Greek Orthodox Church right over there. All Saints Catholic in the Heights. Again, I'm practitioner, but I'm also scholar. So I like to throw this one in and ask, isn't this a religious experience? In many ways, a cult. This is a U of H football game. As, again, the parishioners watch their high priest and priestesses mediating goodness and evil, a cosmic salvation on the field of play. Seriously. There's a lot of scholarship on this as well. Largest church in America, population, or at least attendance-wise. And then all the way to Friends Meeting House in the Heights. That's a Terrell Sky Space. It's a flip top. I did a wedding there about a year and a half ago, right about this time of year, and the roof was open and it was just glorious. It's an incredible space. Chiang Mai Temple in Stafford, Congregation Emmanuel, United Orthodox Synagogue over on Braeswood, Sikh Gurdwara, the Baha'i Center on Fannin, what, 8 blocks away? Mosque in Katy, just grand opening last summer. You may, for those of you who have been in Houston since the mid-2000s, this is the Pig Race Mosque. I don't know if you remember about 2006 when they were starting to acquire land and start the building process. There were some misunderstandings with the landowner, and the gentleman started doing pig races on Fridays. Which is interesting. Obviously, he was trying to do something that was offensive, even though Muslims don't eat pork. They don't have anything against pigs. But it was, again, the symbolism that was important. Nice. This has a good ending. Both it's the Baker family. It's on Baker Road, so the road's named after the prominent family in that area. The mosque and the Baker family are on good terms now, and in fact, I think the family just sold the mosque some more land as they're expanding. The Dawah Center downtown, Muslims of Prayer at Maryam Islamic Center in Sugar Land. So it's fun. It's a really interesting city in which to do this kind of work. I know that a lot of the work that I do intersects with one of the concepts that's in the description of your class, this idea of religious literacy. I don't know if you talk much about what you mean by religious literacy, so I'd like to talk, I can talk a little bit about this. If we're talking about religious literacy, this is, I think, a decent starting point. Defined as a basic understanding of the history, sacred texts, beliefs, rituals, and current manifestations of multiple faith traditions. And, so we're not just talking about the knowledge, but we're talking about application as well. The ability to understand the intersection of religions and socio-political cultural life through multiple lenses. It's that second part that is perhaps even more important. And that's when I would teach world religions at St. John's School, I would often say to the kids, to the students, we're going to talk a lot about facts and figures. But when you go out onto the street, when you go into the classroom, you're not going to see, the word Sanatana Dharma running around the street. You're going to see a person who's Hindu. You're not going to see a word that's running around that says Hajj. You're going to see people talking about, Muslims seeing and talking about the pilgrimage that they were just coming back from. So it's not just the terms, but how do you apply those terms to understand what's going on in the world? I think that's what we talk about with religious literacy. And my thesis is this, is that we lack, in general, basic information and engagement skills in religion and culture that we would not tolerate in other academic disciplines. Much like our attempts to catch up with years of education and not paying attention to the rest of the world, see STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. The lack of basic information and skills when it comes to religious literacy is now coming back to haunt us, whether it be in world politics or the simple ability to talk to our neighbors. And because we're on a journey, and I think the reason that I do what I do is, again, personally speaking, I think a lot of it comes from my experience of being biracial and growing up in northern Wisconsin where there weren't a bunch of other half-Asian kids running around. My father was a pretty well-known doctor, so we couldn't get away with much of anything. We'd run around and someone would say, "You're one of Dr. Han's kids, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah, how many other half-Asian kids are running around north central Wisconsin in the 1980s? I think a lot about being multiracial is about kind of, in some ways, belonging nowhere and belonging everywhere at the same time. So I know the language and the culture and the ideologies of the dominant culture, but just to be blunt, I'm brown enough to be in places and feel comfortable and for people to feel comfortable with me as well. So. And then I just have a love affair, I think, in many ways, with the study of religion. Ministry was my first vocational curiosity, and theology is my academic love and has been for a long time. Ministry is my vocational curiosity, but the fact that I haven't served a church since 2008 will indicate how well perhaps I was able to execute that vocational curiosity. So I needed to find other ways as well. Because in the end, we're all on a journey. I want to show a couple of video clips. And this one is one that I think captures what it is, in some ways, we're all trying to find, or this journey that we're on. This is from a documentary called Baraka. Has anybody seen it? Okay, good. I would highly, highly suggest it. It is a documentary about kind of the human condition and our search for divinity or the search for mystery, but it has no dialogue. It's got no script, and it's got a very unique kind of linear formula that you need to follow carefully. So just a little something. Uh-oh. We had the sound working. Oh, there it is. People are using these impulses, these divine impulses, for incredibly wonderful and beautiful and mysterious reasons and purposes, but also for incredibly destructive purposes as well. But I think the fact of the matter is that we choose ignorance of these impulses at our own peril. Whether it's the use of fire as a purifier here in a Zoroastrian tradition, or its destructive nature, Branch Davidians in Waco. How we orient ourselves through sacred image, whether it's the elephant-headed god Ganesh, and how we could, again, parse this image in, you know, for hours. Or our cosmic, the way that we orient ourselves cosmically, use of a mandala in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. How we construct our identity, whether through classic medieval art, or how Salvador Dali saw the crucifixion, or how Muslims orient themselves around the Kaaba during the Hajj to Mecca. And so maybe some things to consider about religion. Are we religious to find our place in the universe because it's a lonely place? Do we find our place in the universe because it's also an incredibly beautiful, expansive place? Why study it? To understand who we are as homo religiosus, that we're religious people by nature. Of course, overcoming ignorance, achieving a global perspective, and to help us, again, formulate our own beliefs and philosophy on life. Different ways, I'll leave you maybe with a couple of ideas about skills. So this is a 3-minute one, same from Baraka. If you were watching this and we're going to deconstruct its meaning, what sort of things would you see?
Thank you.
In course, sort of coming into the end, some different approaches to religious literacy and what to look for. The first is the idea of the supernatural approach, recognition of a superhuman controlling power, and especially of a personal God entitled to obedience. And so it makes it easy to exclude more problematic religions, for example, football, unless football has a God. And cons, it tends to be too exclusive to be helpful. For example, what do you do with the Buddhist tradition that doesn't necessarily have the idea of a personal God? The dimensional approach, this is done by a philosopher named Ninian Smart. And he's got six areas, doctrinal and philosophical, web of doctrines and beliefs, mythic and narrative, the use of story and narrative, but again, also understanding that secular worldviews use this as well. Ethical and legal, what are the ethics? What are the morals of a religious system? Ritual or practical, we just saw an excellent example of the power of ritual. Experiential or emotional, that feelings are greatly important in religions. Sometimes they set the stage for the origin of a tradition. And then the social or institutional, what are the organizations religions develop? Most religions, I would say, have all of these aspects, but really highlight or are strong in two to three areas. There's the functional approach. What is religion doing? Is it a social glue? Is it the relief of anxiety or of uncertainty or of powerlessness or scarcity? The phenomenological approach, which is a more detached approach, and the idea that you can bracket your own, the sense of bracketing your own beliefs as you're exploring another religious tradition. The confessional approach, what you believe is the truth and it is your obligation to share it. In some way, I would say every religion is confessional. That's why we call it belief and not just a good idea we're entertaining at the time. And finally, the empathetic approach, which you could see as a third way between the phenomenological and the confessional. And you could think about it as lights in a house. And there are lights on inside a house which allow you to look inside at what's going on and what people are doing. The empathetic approach means that we'll knock on the door and be a good guest. And we need to rely on the shared humanity of all. In closing, I think a couple of things when it comes to religious literacy that at least I've thought about a lot recently. And the idea, first of all, is for us to practice radical curiosity, to be really curious again, in some ways to kind of rediscover a sense of naivete, because we have lots of access to information, but information and knowledge, information and wisdom, intelligence and wisdom are very, very different things. Space for reflection. One of my favorite New York Times columns from the last couple of years. Yeah, the picture says it all. The end of reflection. Finding moments to engage in contemplative thinking has always been a challenge since we're distractible. But now that we're carrying these powerful media devices around with us all day long, these opportunities become even less frequent for the simple reason that we have this ability to distract ourselves constantly. Nevertheless, he sees our current direction as indicative of the loss of the contemplative mind, he said. We've adopted the Google ideal of the mind, which is that you have a question that you can answer quickly, close-ended, well-defined. Lost in that conception is that there's also this open-ended way of thinking where you're not always trying to answer a question. You're trying to go where the thought leads you. As a society, we're saying that that way of thinking isn't as important anymore. It's way too inefficient. Because in the end, we're all explorers now. And if I had three rules for interfaith engagement, I'd just steal them. I steal everything, really. This is Krister Stendahl. Krister was the dean of Harvard Divinity School for about 10 years. He was the Lutheran Bishop of Stockholm as well. Lovely, lovely human being. And he has three rules. He says, let the other define, meaning that if you're really interested about what another person believes or thinks, oh my gosh, go ask them. And then actually listen. Most of the time, we aren't listening. We're just waiting our turn. So And also, though, doing all of this, recognizing that you shouldn't make this person represent the faith of 100 million people, 300 million people, a billion people, a billion and a half people. Rule number two is compare best with best. Don't compare the best in one religion with the worst in another religion. And then finally, my favorite is this. He says, don't be afraid to practice holy envy. I love that phrase. Don't be afraid to see something in another tradition that you would say, I will never be that, I will never practice that, I would never do that, but really that's cool. And that informs my own tradition as well. And with that, I say thank you. That's a lot of information, but again, I don't know if you're going to invite me back, so. I think I've left time for, yeah, that was my intent. So, yes, sir. Baraka? Yes, which is a Hebrew word meaning to bless. It's the same in Arabic. It's this Arabic and Hebrew are both Semitic triconsonantal languages, and that b or k sound, triconsonantal sound, means to bless. So I'm sorry. Baraka. Baraka. It's an awesome, it's really, 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 it really is eye-catching and thought-provoking. So. It's the name of that, and it's got a follow-up called Samsara, I think, if I remember correctly, which doesn't always happen. So, yes, ma'am.
Gregory, through your organization, what opportunities are there to work directly with refugees for someone, for volunteers who speaks only English?
Sure. So, at this point, when questions like this happen, this is when I give you a card and I say, you email me and I'll get you in touch with Elena Corbett. Both our Meals on Wheels and Refugee Services programs have dedicated community engagement coordinators. So I would just put you in touch with Elena Corbett at Interfaith, and she can answer all those questions much more effectively and efficiently than I. So, yes, sir. Oh, with the monkey dance? Yeah, the monkey dance. It's out of, I think that's out of Bali. I don't know whether it's Hindu or it could be an indigenous religious tradition. So, other questions? Yes, ma'am.
How is Interfaith Ministries financed?
Interfaith Ministries is financed. We are, yeah.
Sorry.
It's okay. Enjoy. But if someone asks something, I'll just repeat it. Interfaith Ministries, we're about a $19 million yearly budget, and a lot of our funding for Meals on, particularly for Meals on Wheels and Refugee Services, is through government contracts. And then we need to raise the rest from individuals, from foundations, from corporations. But a lot of our funding, and we're really trying to diversify our funding, being at the intersection of interfaith work and refugee work has made our lives rather interesting over the last couple of months. So,
did I understand that there may be lack of funding for Meals on Wheels because of the new administration?
Yes, so I think the concern about refugees and our commitment to refugees here and our funding, that has made it onto the news a lot since January. Probably in the last 3 or 4 weeks, there has been some talk about how some cuts to CDBG's Community Development Block Grants, but it would affect our Meals on Wheels funding. So that's been there. Our primary concern and what we're really watching for, not only is the conversations that are going on right now, but if and when the Older Americans Act comes up under the chopping block. Because for Meals on Wheels programs nationally, the bulk of it comes through OAA, the Older Americans Act. So that's the one we're really watching, though we're watching what's going on right now, because there is some concern about Meals on Wheels funding. Wayne, please.
Could you explain a little bit about how the refugee process works? That is, once somebody goes through this 24-month period, you mentioned, what happens?
So what happens is if they come through the process, this process here, biometric screens, you name it, there's an unbelievable gamut that refugees need to come through. Then they come to us, and then we have people on staff that speak multiple languages, that understand the compliance process, understand the paperwork process, and then we follow them through this whole process of them basically coming to Houston with whatever they can carry. Our funding then allows for rent, and then like a plate, a spoon, a cup, a fork per person. So that's where a lot of donations are really helpful to make basically what we're able to provide them at a real basic level, then to add more on top of that, so the house can start to feel like, or the apartment can start to feel like a home. Jobs, training, jobs, English, kids in school, all of those things. As soon as they arrive here, they become our responsibility for getting them integrated into American society and becoming productive members of society. Yeah. Yes, sir. Okay.
What attempts do you all make to counteract or counterpoint the bad religion?
Loves to. Okay. So, question number one: are there other interfaith organizations? The answer is yes. There's no franchising in many ways because interfaith work is so contextual, because what we are able to do here in Houston is so different from what they could do in Waco, for example, or Austin, or even Philly. So there's no umbrella organization. There is, I think there is a National Interfaith Alliance. The Parliament of Religions sometimes serves as a hub for people getting together. So a lot of our communal national work is done just network-wise. So for example, I'm on a conference call probably every month or so with probably four or five other organizations, but that's only happening because one particular organization has taken them on themselves to reach out, figure out who's doing what, find the right contact people, and then organize a conference call. So we're not part of a national organization. Now, Meals on Wheels, for sure. We're a member of Meals on Wheels of Texas and then Meals on Wheels of America. So our service areas can do that. But when it comes to interfaith work, we're more intentional networks more than overseen by some national organization. What are interfaith organizations doing when it comes to bad religion? I think there's two ways to do it. The first is what, to use a kind of a violent metaphor, a lot of it is hand-to-hand combat. Just into communities, whether it be St. Paul's or a church out in the Woodlands or a church out in Cyprus. It's building those relationships and then getting an opportunity to come speak and talk with people. Because often what happens is that when you have an interfaith event, the people who come are the people you don't need to be talking to. You're preaching to the choir. We talk all the time about how to reach to that next layer of folks. The other way to do it that other we do is through programs, through communications. We're looking to run maybe a larger PR campaign. We're calling it Respect Thy Neighbor, which is trying to communicate to the larger city of Houston and the area the importance about respect. And that respect needs to not just be about, not across just religious lines, but across all lines. So there's larger messaging that's also part of the process as well. But when it comes to it, a lot of it is trying to find ways to talk to people who are interested in getting good information or different information, but don't usually have regular access to that. And that just requires a lot of time and effort. So I'll answer it that way. Yes, sir. Oh. So interfaith has been involved in a variety of things over the years. I don't think homelessness has ever been our bread and butter. I'm sure we've been involved just because of our desire to connect with religious communities, and religious communities often work with things regarding homelessness. We're not doing much with homelessness at this point right now. We've really focused on with our Meals on Wheels and our refugee services work and trying to do that really, really well. We can do two more?
Well,
oh, sorry.
Sure.
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I?
I want to make sure you get out on time. You have a flight to catch.
I just want to make sure. Okay. I can do two more. Interfaith Ministries, we aren't an advocacy organization. So we try to occupy that unique space of being a convener, a hub, a place where people can gather. We will, I think, when it comes to our service areas, definitely make our voice known when it comes with refugee services and Meals on Wheels, understandably so. But other areas, knowing we try to point people, if they're interested in advocacy, to other groups that are doing that good work, like the Anti-Defamation League. We really try to occupy that unique space of trying to be a place where people can gather and talk about difficult things, often with people who disagree. It is. We've, I think, focused in particular our voice with refugees and have let other organizations who are really strong on immigration, because those are two very different realms, but we try to partner with them. Last question. Both of those videos, actually, I stole from YouTube. So if you Google Baraka, you'll bring those up. So those are already online. So I'm happy to continue the conversation. Let this be the first part, not the last part. I've got cards. You can find me online. Thank you very much for your time.
Please joining me in thanking Reverend Hahn. Thank you so much. Yeah, really, really appreciate it. Yeah.